Okay, let's talk taxes. Specifically, the kind of taxes that, well, they land squarely on property owners and businesses with physical buildings, equipment, everything tangible. Because let's be honest, trying to figure out if fixing a roof leak is a simple repair you can write off immediately, or if replacing the whole HVAC system is a costly improvement you have to capitalize and depreciate for years. I mean, it can feel like a financial guesswork nightmare.
It absolutely can. And that guesswork, it isn't just a headache. Getting it wrong can cost you real money in taxes and potential penalties, too.
Which is exactly why we're doing a deep dive today into something designed to bring some clarity, hopefully, to that confusion. The tangible property regulations, or the TPRs, as they're often called.
Right, the TPRs. And these regulations are absolutely foundational for managing the tax life of any tangible property you own or even lease for your business.
And we're pulling insights today from an ebook our listener shared, focused specifically on, TPR compliance and how understanding these rules can tie into broader strategies, maybe like those discussed by outfits like Profits USA.
Okay.
So our mission today, let's unpack the most important need-to-know concepts from this source. We want to help you understand the rules, identify opportunities for real tax savings, and hopefully confidently avoid expensive mistakes.
And the first critical point to grasp is that these rules, they aren't optional suggestions. Not at all. They've actually been mandatory for businesses since way back in 2014.
Since 2014, wow.
Yeah, the IRS basically took decades of scattered court decisions and rulings and pulled them together into one structured framework.
So they're not exactly new, but they're still, well, confusing for a lot of people, it seems. But the key is mastering this isn't just about checking a box for compliance, is it?
Not at all. It directly impacts your tax bill and, critically, the cash flow available for your business operations.
Right, cash flow.
Yeah.
Okay, so why did the IRS go to all the trouble of consolidating this into the TPRs? What was the main goal?
Well, at its heart, the goal was really to create a clear, consistent framework, something to help distinguish between those routine business expenses you can deduct immediately, think simple repairs, and those larger capital expenditures that, need to be capitalized and depreciated over time, the improvements.
Oh, okay.
It was really all about reducing subjectivity and cutting down on those disputes between taxpayers and the IRS.
Less arguing with the tax man, more certainty about what's what. I like the sound of that.
Exactly. And the payoff for you, the taxpayer, when you do get this right, it can be significant. Properly applying the TPRs helps you implement optimal tax strategies, often leading to increased write-offs, potentially lower tax liabilities, and ultimately, like you said, more cash in your business.
Okay, so there's a definite upside. What's the risk if you just sort of ignore them? Or maybe you just haven't gotten around to fully understanding them yet.
The downside is serious. Non-compliance can trigger significant penalties. The TPRs actually require an annual review and potential correction of your depreciation schedules.
Annual, wow.
Yes. If you're not doing that, you risk disallowed depreciation deductions, fines, and you significantly increase your chances of an IRS audit. And fixing past non-compliance, well, that often means grappling with the notoriously complex IRS Form 3115, the application for change of accounting method.
Yeah, Form 3115 is pretty much on everyone's list of things I really hope to avoid. So let's figure out how to get it right and avoid that. Where do we even start when we're looking at work done on a property? How do these rules begin?
Okay, the entire analysis under the TPRs, it really begins with correctly identifying the specific asset you're actually working on. This is called the unit of property, or UOP for short.
The UOP, unit of property. How do you define that for tax purposes? What does that mean practically?
Generally, it's defined by what's functionally interdependent, so components that rely on each other to operate. For buildings, unless you have physically connected structures like a campus, each standalone building is typically considered a single UOP.
Okay, so why is getting the UOP right so critical? Does it really matter if I call it the building or, say, just the specific HVAC system I'm fixing?
Oh, it matters immensely. All the capitalization decisions, whether something is an expense or an improvement, they're made relative to that UOP.
Relative to the UOP, okay.
Yeah, the rules judge the materiality of an expenditure against that UOP's cost basis. Think about it. Spending, say, $15,000 on a small $35,000 piece of equipment, that's a huge percentage of its value, very likely an improvement.
Right.
But spending that same $15,000 on a large, say, $350,000 building, that might easily be considered a routine repair relative to the overall asset. The size and the cost basis of the UOP fundamentally influence whether work gets classified as a repair or an improvement.
Ah, okay. So materiality really means significant compared to the whole. And cost basis is generally what you paid for the asset, plus maybe certain costs to get it ready for use.
Exactly. It's your tax cost on the property, essentially. Now, for buildings specifically, even though the whole building is usually one UOP, the rules actually require you to analyze the work done on its defined systems separately when deciding whether to capitalize.
So you look at the work done on the whole building as one UOP, but then you have to drill down into the specific systems within that building.
Precisely. The source highlights nine common building systems that you need to consider separately for this capitalization analysis: HVAC, plumbing, electrical, fire protection, security, elevators and escalators, landscaping, site improvements, and then maybe any other specialized system specific to your building's use, like for manufacturing or something. Understanding which system the work impacts is kind of the next layer of analysis after identifying the UOP.
Okay, that makes sense. You're getting more granular step by step. And this leads us to something the source mentions that feels like a really positive change from older rules, this concept of loss on component retirement. Tell us about that.
Ah, yes. This is where it gets really interesting and offers a tangible benefit. In the past, if you replaced a significant part of a building system, maybe an old HVAC unit or a section of roofing, you often had to keep depreciating the old retired part, even though it was gone, and then capitalize the new one separately.
That seems crazy. You're depreciating something that doesn't even exist anymore. It's in a landfill somewhere.
Right. It wasn't intuitive and it definitely wasn't tax efficient. But under the PPRs, when you retire or dispose of a major component within a UOP and replace it, you can actually claim an immediate tax loss for the undepreciated cost basis of that old component in the year it's removed.
Whoa, hang on. An immediate deduction for the remaining book value of the thing you just ripped out.
Yes. And what's more, the cost of removing that old component is also typically deductible immediately. This new rule provides a real cash flow advantage by giving you a current deduction instead of making you wait years to depreciate something that's, no longer providing any benefit.
That is a huge shift, a really positive one. Okay, so we've identified the UOP, potentially drilled down into the building systems, and we know about this immediate deduction for retired components. The source also talks about ways the rules try to make things simpler, these safe harbors.
Yes. The TPRs offer several optional safe harbors. These are essentially administrative shortcuts designed to make life a bit easier. If your expenditure fits the criteria of a safe harbor, you can generally expense it directly without needing the detailed, often complex analysis under the RB rules we'll discuss next.
Okay, administrative convenience. I like that.
They provide certainty and simplify compliance for certain types of costs.
Which ones are most important for property owners? Which ones should we really focus on?
The source highlights three key safe harbors. The first one is the de minimis safe harbor, or DMSH.
De minimis, like
Yep.
minimal cost. So small items, little things.
Precisely. This one allows you to expense low-cost items or invoices below a specific dollar threshold per item or invoice. It really cuts down on the administrative hassle of capitalizing and tracking really small purchases or improvements.
Okay, what's the threshold?
The threshold is $2,500 per item or per invoice.
$2,500. Okay, that seems like a useful number. Does that ever change?
It does go up if you have what's called an applicable financial statement, AFS, which typically means you have audited financial statements. If you have an AFS, the threshold jumps to $5,000 per item or invoice.
Ah, okay.
But for many businesses, especially smaller ones without audits, that $2,500 is the key number to remember.
Is this something I just do, or do I have to formally tell the IRS I'm doing it?
That's a crucial point. The DMSH is an annual election. You have to make this choice each year by attaching a specific statement to your timely filed tax return. It is not automatic. You have to elect in.
Got it. Annual election. What kind of things can you use it for? Materials, supplies.
It applies pretty broadly, yeah. Materials, supplies, even the acquisition costs of individual components within a UOP, as long as the cost per item or invoice is under that threshold. The source points out it can even apply to certain spare parts, like those used on a rotating basis, temporary parts, or standby emergency parts if they meet that cost test.
Are there any gotchas? Things it definitely doesn't cover.
Yes, definitely. It doesn't apply to land. It doesn't apply to intangible property like software, although software often has its own expensing rules, like Section 179 for off-the-shelf stuff.
Right.
And it doesn't apply to materials used in manufacturing inventory that are normally capitalized as part of inventory cost. Also, very importantly, there's an anti-abuse rule. You can't intentionally split invoices just to sneak under the threshold. The IRS frowns on that.
Okay, makes sense. Don't try to game the system. So, DMSH for small individual costs requires an election. What's the second safe harbor you mentioned?
That's the safe harbor for small taxpayers, the STSH. As the name suggests, this one is specifically aimed at providing a tax advantage for, well, smaller businesses undertaking work on their buildings.
How small do you have to be to qualify for this one? What are the criteria?
You need to meet two tests. First, your average annual gross receipts, AGR, over the past three tax years must be $10 million or less.
Okay, $10 million AGR or less.
And second, the unadjusted basis of the building you're actually doing the work on must be $1 million or less. Unadjusted basis meaning basically the original cost before depreciation.
Okay, so both your overall business size and the specific building size matter here. And what does it let you expense if you qualify?
If you qualify and you make the annual election, this one also requires an election each year, you can expense your total annual expenditures for building improvements, repairs, and maintenance on that qualifying building. But there's a critical cap.
Always a catch. What's the cap?
The amount you can expense under the safe harbor is limited to the lesser of two amounts, $10,000 or 2% of the building's unadjusted basis.
So even if I spend, say, $20,000 on repairs and improvements on a qualifying building, I might only be able to expense $10,000, or maybe even less, if 2% of the basis is lower than $10.
Exactly. You get the lower of those two numbers as your maximum deduction under STSH. And here's the other big catch the source highlights. It's an all-or-nothing provision.
All-or-nothing.
Yes. If your total annual expenditures for work on that building exceed the calculated limit, the lesser of $10 or 2% basis, then none of those costs qualify for this specific safe harbor deduction for that year. You fall out completely.
Yikes. So you really need to track your spending carefully throughout the year if you plan to use this one. Make sure you don't accidentally go over the limit.
Absolutely critical. And the source also notes it doesn't apply to land improvements, just the building itself.
Okay. And there was an interesting connection mentioned about cost segregation here.
Yes, this is quite interesting. A cost segregation study might actually help you qualify for the STSH. How? Well, by potentially reclassifying some of the building's costs to personal property, which lowers the building's remaining unadjusted basis. If that lowered basis drops below the $1 million threshold, a building that previously didn't qualify might now become eligible for the STSH in future years.
Wow. Okay. So cost segregation isn't just about getting faster depreciation. It could actually help you unlock these immediate expensing opportunities under the STSH too. That's a fascinating connection. All right, what's the third and final safe harbor?
That's the routine maintenance safe harbor, or RMSH. Now, this one is different from the first two because it's automatic if you meet the criteria. It doesn't require an annual election.
Automatic sounds good. Less paperwork. What are the criteria for something to be considered routine maintenance?
The expenditures must be for maintenance that is, one, reasonably expected to occur more than once during the property's class life, which is often simplified to more than once within 10 years for buildings.
Okay, recurring work.
Right. And two, it's work done just to keep the asset functioning efficiently in its ordinary operating condition. Not to improve it, just maintain it.
So like preventative maintenance.
Yeah.
Regular upkeep.
Yes, exactly. And minor repairs. The examples usually given are things like regular servicing of your HVAC system, maybe patching small sections of a roof damaged by a storm, minor electrical or plumbing repairs that don't involve replacing major components, painting, cleaning, things like that.
Okay.
The key is that these costs are for preserving the existing function of the property, keeping it going as it is.
So the line seems to be drawn pretty clearly between maintaining what you already have versus making it better or significantly changing it.
Precisely. The RMSH explicitly states that the work must not be a capital improvement. It can't enlarge the property, adapt it to a new use, or materially increase its productivity, efficiency, strength, or quality beyond its original condition or standard.
So replacing a significant portion of your roof or upgrading to a much more efficient HVAC system that's probably out for RMSH.
Generally, yes. That usually falls into capital improvement territory. But patching a leak or getting your existing system service that's typically routine maintenance under RMSH, that distinction is absolutely vital.
Got it. So recapping the safe harbors, we have DMSH for small individual costs, but you need to elect it annually. We have STSH for small businesses with smaller buildings doing work up to a certain cap, also needs an annual election, and it's all or nothing. And then RMSH for regular upkeep, which is automatic if you meet the criteria.
That's a good summary.
So what happens if an expenditure is too large for the DMSH? Maybe your business or building is too big for the STSH. or the work clearly goes beyond just routine maintenance, where do you go then?
If the work doesn't clearly fit into one of those safe harbors, then you must turn to the general capitalization rules. These are often summarized by the acronym RBI. You have to apply these tests to determine if the cost must be capitalized.
RBI rules. Okay, what does RBI stand for?
It stands for Restoration, Adaptation, Betterment, and Improvement. If the work done on your UOP or one of its systems falls under any of these categories, it's generally considered a capital expenditure. You have to capitalize it and depreciate it over time.
Okay, let's briefly touch on what each of those means in practice. Restoration.
Sure. Restoration is basically about bringing a UOP back to its normal operating condition after it's fallen into disrepair, or maybe rebuilding it to a like new state after its depreciable life is over, or replacing a major component or a substantial structural part of the UOP.
So fixing something that's broken down or worn out significantly.
Exactly, bringing it back. Adaptation is about changing the UOP to a new or different use. Think converting an old warehouse into loft apartments or repurposing a retail space into, say, a restaurant.
Changing its fundamental purpose. Got it.
Right. Betterment is about enhancing the condition or the value of the UOP beyond its original state when you first placed it in service. This includes fixing a material defect that existed when you acquired it, but maybe you didn't know about, or adding a significant component that wasn't there before, or making a significant improvement to its productivity, efficiency, strength, or quality.
Okay, making it demonstrably better.
Yes. And the source notes that things like affecting more than, say, 33% of, like, components or making the asset more than 10% more efficient or larger can often point towards a betterment. These are sort of rules of thumb that can indicate significance.
And improvement, is that different from betterment?
Improvement is sometimes used as sort of an umbrella term covering all of RBI. But when it's used more narrowly in the regulations, it often ties back to those betterment criteria work that results in a betterment or a restoration or an adaptation is generally considered an improvement that must be capitalized. It emphasizes the overall impact on the property's value or function measured relative to the UOP.
Applying these RB tests sounds, well, less straightforward than checking the boxes for the safe harbors. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely less straightforward. Determining if something meets one of the RBI tests requires a much more detailed analysis. You have to consider both quantitative factors, like the cost relative to the UOP's basis, and qualitative factors, the actual nature of the work, its impact on the property's condition, its function, its lifespan. It's definitely not always a simple calculation or a clear-cut yes-no decision. This is often where the complexity and the potential for disagreement lies.
Okay, so navigating all this seems like quite a bit just to stay compliant and avoid those penalties we talked about. But the source really emphasizes that understanding TPRs isn't just a burden, it's actually a significant opportunity. How can you turn this compliance requirement into a financial win?
That's the key shift in thinking. Exactly. TPRs aren't just about following rules. They actually provide powerful tools for strategic tax planning if you know how to use them. The source highlights two major opportunities where you can potentially unlock significant tax savings.
Okay, let's hear them. Let's start with the one that lets you look back. Section 481A, adjustments. What's that about?
Yes. This is a huge potential benefit, especially if, maybe, you haven't been fully compliant with the TPRs since they became mandatory in 2014, or perhaps if you've been consistently capitalizing costs over the years that would now be clearly deductible as repairs under the current clarified rules.
Okay.
Section 481A allows you to essentially make a catch-up adjustment. You can go back, adopt the correct TPR accounting methods now, and potentially expense in the current year costs you previously capitalized in prior years that, under today's rules, actually qualify as repairs or maintenance.
Wait a minute. Let me get this straight. I could potentially get a deduction today for something I paid for and started depreciating, say, 5 years ago, if it should have been expensed back then under these rules. That seems huge.
It can be a very significant boost to your current year deductions, absolutely reducing taxable income. Generally, if you've consistently applied either the RBI rules or the safe harbor since 2015, or if you're now adopting the correct methods, you're typically eligible to make this adjustment. It allows you to essentially reclaim tax savings that might have been missed in the past.
Okay.
Now, this generally does require filing that Form 3115 we talked about, the application for change in accounting method, which can be complex. But the potential tax savings from this catch-up deduction can often far outweigh the hassle and cost of preparing the form.
Right. So 481A is about correcting the past and getting a potentially large current benefit. What's the second big opportunity the source highlights.
That's the partial asset disposition, or PAD. This is particularly valuable when you're doing renovations or improvements on a property and you replace existing components. Think about replacing an old roof section, upgrading a building's main electrical panel, tearing out old flooring to put in new, replacing specific windows, things like that.
Okay, how does the PAD work as an opportunity when I'm doing those kinds of renovations?
When you dispose of that old component as part of the renovation, the part you're tearing out and replacing, the PAD rule, allows you to recognize an immediate tax loss for the remaining undepreciated cost basis of that specific old asset that you removed.
Ah, so instead of just adding the cost of due asset to my depreciation schedule, I can actually write off the remaining value of the old asset that's being thrown away.
Exactly. Plus, just like with the loss on component retirement rule we mentioned earlier, for components replaced outside of major renovations, the costs associated with removing that old asset during the renovation are also generally deductible immediately. This directly reduces your current year taxable income, often significantly.
This feels like a really tangible, immediate benefit when you're undertaking those costly renovation projects. What's the key thing to remember about using the PAD? Is there a trick?
This is where it gets really critical, and the source stresses this. The PAD is essentially a use-it-or-lose-it opportunity. You must claim this partial disposition and the associated tax loss in the same tax year the renovation or replacement occurs.
The same year.
Right. Yes. If you fail to identify that specific old component, document its remaining basis, and claim the loss in that year, you permanently forfeit that deduction. You can't go back later and say, oh, I forgot to take that loss 2 years ago. It's gone.
Wow. Okay. So the timing and the documentation, knowing the basis of the thing you removed, are absolutely critical here.
They couldn't be more critical.
Yeah.
Claiming a PAD also has the benefit of improving the accuracy of your depreciation schedule going forward because it removes assets that are no longer actually in service, which helps avoid potential issues like excess depreciation recapture when you eventually sell the property.
That makes sense. How do you claim it? Is it another Form 3115 situation?
Generally, for timely elections made after 2014, you report this loss directly on your tax return for the year of disposition, often without needing a Form 3115. You just need the documentation to support the loss calculation. Now, the source does note that late elections for prior years, which were available through 2014, did require Form 3115.
Okay. And I imagine figuring out the basis of that old roof section or those specific windows you replaced years ago can be tough.
Extremely tough sometimes. And this is where the source highlights again that a cost segregation study can be incredibly helpful. A good study often breaks down the original building cost into its components, providing the necessary documentation to determine the specific cost basis of those older components being replaced. It makes claiming the PAD much easier and more defensible.
So again, cost segregation isn't just its own strategy. It can directly support and enhance these TPR strategies like the PAD. That interconnection seems really powerful. Okay, let's try and bring it all together then. What's the key takeaway about compliance and maybe getting some help with all this complexity?
Well, the big picture, to reiterate, is that TPR compliance isn't optional. It's mandatory, and it really requires ongoing attention, including that annual review and adjustment of your depreciation schedules.
And you mentioned earlier that ensuring TPR compliance might be a kind of foundational step, maybe even before other things.
Yes. The source suggests it's often advisable strategically to make sure you're fully compliant with TPRs first. Perhaps undertake that look-back analysis using Section 481A to catch up on any missed expensing opportunities before pursuing other elective strategies like a cost segregation study.
Why that order?
Because many items that can be expensed immediately under the TPRs through safe harbors or the RB analysis offer a greater, more immediate tax benefit than capitalizing and depreciating them, even on an accelerated schedule you might get from a cost seg study. Maximize your immediate expensing opportunities under the mandatory TPRs first, then look at optimizing depreciation for what remains capitalized.
That makes perfect sense from a cash flow perspective. Get the immediate deductions first. And if you do need to change your accounting methods to adopt TPRs formally, or make those 481A adjustments, or maybe certain late PAD elections, that complex Form 3115 is definitely required.
That's right. Form 3115 is the official mechanism for obtaining IRS consent to change your method of accounting, which is necessary for these specific types of actions. And it requires quite a bit of detailed information about the change being requested.
It really sounds like this is an area where just guessing or trying to piece it together on your own from, you know, reading IRS publications could be pretty risky.
It really is. The source material makes it very clear that TPRs are intricate. They combine specific dollar thresholds and rules with, frankly, subjective judgment calls under the RB Guy tests. Expert guidance is often invaluable, not just for ensuring proper compliance and avoiding those nasty penalties, but critically for identifying and maximizing those tax-saving opportunities like the 481A adjustments and the partial asset dispositions. There are specialized firms out there that focus specifically on navigating these exact complexities for property owners.
Because getting it wrong means not just potentially missing out on significant savings, but also facing those audit risks and penalties we discussed at the beginning.
Exactly. Non-compliance definitely increases your IRS audit risk, which is always disruptive and costly, even if you ultimately win. And the penalties themselves can include disallowed deductions stretching back years, plus interest and specific failure to comply fines. Getting it right protects you and, very often, puts significant money back in your pocket through tax saving.
So really, understanding these tangible property regulations is about transforming what feels like a potential tax burden or headache into a strategic financial advantage. By properly applying these rules, you can significantly impact your taxable income and boost your cash flow, primarily by expensing costs immediately whenever possible, instead of depreciating them slowly over decades.
It's really about being proactive rather than reactive with these costs, turning complex rules into a powerful tool for your business's financial health.
Absolutely. So, knowing that these tangible property regulations are mandatory, can be complex, but also offer significant tax benefits if applied correctly and strategically. Here's a thought for you, our listener. What previously capitalized costs sitting on your depreciation schedule right now, related to your property, might actually be eligible for an immediate deduction under today's rules. It just might be worth taking a closer look back to find out.